Welcome to the Commerce and Consumer Protection Committee, March 12th, 2024. Senator Umover-Bayton. Senator Umover-Bayton. Welcome to the committee, Senator. We have Senate File 4735 in front of us, and I think you have an author's amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I do have an author's amendment.
Senator Seeberger offers the A2 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Bill is in the shape you would like it. To your bill, Senator Umover-Bayton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Senate File 4735 strengthens the Student Loan Borrower Bill of Rights. The original Student Loan Borrower Bill of Rights passed with bipartisan support in 2021. And a few things have changed since the law passed that have made it clear this needs some updating. Student loan payments resumed in September. When the initial law was passed, student loan payments were paused nationwide. The federal government has also implemented a sweeping new income-driven repayment plan called the SAVE plan. And since its rollout, we've seen student loan servicers improperly handle millions of SAVE plan applications. Senate File 4735 adds additional reporting and registration requirements for lenders who provide services in Minnesota. It requires student loan servicers to evaluate borrowers for income-driven repayment plans before placing them in forbearance or default. It strengthens language around misleading borrowers, and lastly, it creates a private right of action for borrowers. I'm happy to walk folks through the bill section by section. The first section just updates the definition of student loans. The second section adds a definition of lender to the Student Loan Borrower Bill of Rights. Section 3 outlines the reporting requirements for student loan servicers operating in the state, as well as servicers who acquire or assume student loans in the state. Those reports are due by January 31st, 2025, and I'll just highlight a few things in the reporting requirements that I think are particularly important. Having a list of schools attended by borrowers, the number of student loans, and the total outstanding dollar amount owed by borrowers, the rate of default for borrowers, the range of initial interest rates for student loans, and copies of model loan agreements. Section 4 outlines the registration requirements for lenders who provide services in Minnesota. Those reports are due January 1st, 2025. They must include the lender's name and address, as well as the name and address for all officers, directors, partners, and owners of controlling interest in the lender. This section also gives the commissioner authority to adopt and enforce additional licensing requirements for lenders. Section 5 clarifies existing language in the Student Loan Borrower Bill of Rights pertaining to the transfer of a student loan. If a borrower's student loan servicer changes, the original student loan servicer must require that the new student loan servicer honors all the benefits that were made available or may have been made available, including any benefits that the borrower hasn't qualified for yet. Section 6 requires student loan servicers to include the following information on their websites: a description of any income-driven repayment plans that are offered, and information on the policies and procedures the servicer uses to evaluate income-driven repayment program requests, including any options available to the student in the loan agreement or marketing materials. Section 7 clarifies what it means to mislead a borrower. Section 8 clarifies that a servicer must not misapply student loan payments to the outstanding balance of a student loan. Section 9 prohibits servicers from providing incorrect information relating to forbearance. If a servicer violates this, they would be subject to the penalties provided in the private right of action. Section 10 adds that a student loan servicer must not obtain property by fraud or misrepresentation. Section 11 adds that a student loan servicer must not allow a borrower to remain on hold with a customer service representative for more than 2 hours. Section 12 adds that a student loan servicer must not engage in abusive acts or practices when servicing a student loan in the state. It outlines those abusive acts or practices, for example, interfering with a borrower's ability to understand a term or condition of a loan. Section 13 cites that a violation of this section is unlawful under Minnesota's Deceptive Trade Practices Act. And then finally, Section 14 creates a private right of action.
Lots of stuff here, and I still have a few more comments, Mr. Chair, about why this is so important, if I can proceed. The student loan crisis is unprecedented in our country, and the market, the student loan market, sits at $1.7 trillion. It's larger than our markets for car loans and credit cards, and second only to mortgages. As of 2020, there were 775,000 student loan borrowers in Minnesota with an average debt over $37,000. Over 85,000 were also in delinquency. This is just a huge issue for my generation and very personal to me. I graduated with roughly $70,000 of student debt, and then when I married my lovely husband, gained about another $100,000 in student debt. And our monthly student loan payments are actually more than our mortgage. When we became homeowners in 2020, we couldn't have done that without student loan payments being on pause. It was really the money that we were able to save in that time that allowed us to put a down payment on a home. We know that the student debt crisis is a racial justice issue. It is widening the racial wealth gap in our state. And it also just takes me back to being like a teenager and applying for these loans, just trying to figure out how you're going to pay for college. And I remember reviewing financial aid packages, just feeling this immense dread. And then when graduating, you know, getting set up, having those payments that were due for my first student loan servicer, and just seeing how much I owed and how many years it was going to take to pay that off. I think when you're a teenager, it's hard to truly grasp, right, the impact that this debt is going to have on your life. And there's also an implicit level of trust that our students and their families have when they're taking out these loans with the federal government. There's an expectation that the Department of Education is going to make sure that those contracts are executed honestly and securely. Many students don't even know that they will start repaying, when they start repaying their loans, that their contract is actually going to go to a servicer, and it can be chopped around several times. In my case, I've had four different student loan servicers over the past decade. I have gone through applying for public service forgiveness. I've contacted employers and got all the right forms, been trying to do all the right things to pay back, and it's still really frustrating. It's really confusing and overwhelming, and I see why a lot of borrowers just kind of feel like giving up because they're trying to navigate this really complicated process. And I think it's important for folks to know when they're doing the right thing, like it's not your fault. When you're trying to play by the rules and you're trying to pay off your debt, if you're facing this mistreatment from loan servicers. And it's also very much documented. There was a study released in the last month from the Student Borrower Protection Center detailing some of that misconduct from just one federal loan servicer, Mohila, towards its borrowers. There's a lot of examples in there, but just to highlight a few, they have created a backlog of over 800,000 public service loan forgiveness program forms. So they're denying borrowers the relief that they're entitled to and continuing to improperly bill folks who should have had their balances canceled. They have had wait times on the phone for up to 9 hours. There's also internal documents showing that they've encouraged their staff to participate in a call deflection scheme that steers customers away from speaking to a live representative and denying borrowers the opportunity to seek assistance for incorrect payments. A lot of misconduct that has been documented. And I'm happy to go through those with folks. But what I just want to end with saying is that strong state regulation of student loan servicers can really work in harmony with our federal guidelines and ensure that our borrowers have proper recourse when they're mistreated. Servicers expect borrowers to pay back their loans, so borrowers should really expect in return that servicers are going to treat them fairly and properly service those loan payments. And there's just a really stark imbalance right now where servicers are able to flout the law and borrowers just don't have enough resources to hold them accountable. So this bill is really about balancing those scales and empowering our state watchdogs like the Department of Commerce, the Attorney General's office to really go after bad actors, having just higher standards of conduct, empowering our borrowers to seek justice when they're treated unfairly, and then just for the hundreds of thousands of Minnesotans who are now paying back their student debt, I think they just deserve to have peace of mind and to know that the state will protect them. So I will end there and then invite up our testifiers.
Thank you, Senator. Members, a quorum is present. For the members' information, a fiscal note has been requested on 4735 and is not yet available. We will be passing it to Judiciary. Could Mr. Ben Reimler and Ms. Nora Simonetti please come forward? Mr. Reimler, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Chair Klein, Ranking Member Dames, and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. For the record, my name is Ben Reimler. I am the Director of Government Relations for Students United. Students United is the statewide student association representing all current, future, and former students of Minnesota State's seven universities. We are so very grateful for Senator Umover-Bayden's leadership in authoring Senate File 4735, and we appreciate Chair Klein and this committee for hearing the bill. Students United would also like to thank Senator Duckworth for his leadership in being a champion of the original Student Borrower Bill of Rights in 2021. With that law as a benchmark, we now encourage lawmakers to take further action to protect borrowers across our state. With almost $30 billion in collectively held outstanding student loan debt, the student debt crisis is a reality experienced by thousands across our state. Right now, we have more than 85,000 Minnesotans in delinquency, and student loan debt is a significant drag on our state's economy, an exhausting crisis for those struggling to afford their monthly payments. In a story that Senator Umover-Bayden laid out and that will sound familiar to thousands of borrowers across our state and many in this room, I would imagine, I can tell you firsthand that the return to repayment has not been smooth, especially after my loans were transferred to a different servicing company during the payment pause. For these reasons, we know it's time to expand Minnesota's Student Borrower Bill of Rights. Students United is asking lawmakers to follow the examples of other states, establish an individual right of action, clarify Minnesota's role and authority in market monitoring. And additionally, Senate File 4735 would create a more transparent student loan system in Minnesota by establishing a registration requirement. Once again, thank you for the opportunity to testify today, and we ask members to support this legislation.
Thank you, Mr. Reimler. Ms. Simonday, please introduce yourself and proceed.
Chair Klein, Ranking Member Dames, and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. For the record, my name is Nora Simondette. I'm a student at Minnesota State University Moorhead and serve on the Board of Directors of Students United. I'm here today to share my support for SF 4735. Because like so many of my peers, when I graduate, I'll be beginning not only my career, but also my student loan payments. I'm grateful for my education at Minnesota State University Moorhead. Once I graduate, I'm excited to find opportunities to contribute to a community in greater Minnesota. But my looming loan repayment is daunting. Students United has long advocated for student loan relief and protections because of the burden and toll that student loan debt carries for Minnesotans like me. Senate File 4735 signals that lawmakers are serious about protecting the rights and voices of student loan borrowers across our state. This bill will ensure that students have a fair and transparent student loan system in our state. Senate File 4735 will also protect the rights of students and student loan borrowers like me, ensuring we are protected from wrongdoing by student loan services. Once again, thank you for the opportunity to testify today, and I hope you will support this bill.
Thank you, Ms. Simonday. Questions or comments or amendments from members? Senator Rest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Umover-Bayden, are there major differences between the bill as introduced and the DE amendment that we adopted? And if you could point those out to us, please.
Senator Umover-Bayden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Rest. There's a few differences. This is really the result of us walking through the proposed changes with both the Department of Commerce, Attorney General's Office, the folks who would be impacted. The original bill didn't have the dates for the reports. We also added in the reference to, I'm just pulling that up, the Deceptive Trade Practices Act. There might have been some reworking of just like the numbering of the reports. But I think the main feedback was really to get those deadlines, to get that reference in there. Otherwise, I'm seeing pretty similar language.
Senator, we move debate, and I'm going to go to council for some additional comments.
Thank you.
Ms. Siverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. One other change that happened in this DE is the addition of the definition lender. And so one of the main changes is that the registration only applies to lenders and doesn't apply to the student loan servicers.
Yeah. Senator Rest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Senator.
Senator Rasmussen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Umu-Verbaten, a question. When we're looking at the private right of action and we're talking about a borrower suffering damages, could you explain an example of what those damages could be?
Senator Umu-Verbaten, possibly a question for the Judiciary Committee as well. Senator Umu-Verbaten.
Mr. Chair, yeah, just give me a moment. I'm looking through another piece of the bill.
While you do that, I'll go back to Senator Rasmussen.
And thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to the bill author. I'm looking at the, I believe it's the A2, which is the delete everything that was adopted. And so I'm looking at line 7.7, the private right of action. And it states a borrower who suffers damage as a result of the failure of a student loan servicer to comply with this chapter may bring an action. And I'm just wondering what that damage could be, or if you could give some examples of what that damage could look like.
Senator Umu-Verbaten.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Senator Rasmussen. I talked about some examples from one student loan servicer, Mohila. I think a good example would be this backlog that they have of folks on the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program. So by not fulfilling their contract and making sure that folks who are eligible for that program are receiving that relief, they may be continuing to make payments that they should not be making payments on anymore. So they're making monthly payments even though they are eligible for public service forgiveness. And the servicer has, you know, improperly managed that that program.
Senator Rasmussen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to the bill author. Another question, when I look at the abusive acts or practices starting at 6.17, and we talk about, you know, a student loan servicer must not engage in abusive acts or practices when servicing a student loan in this state. And as a part of that, we go down to line 6.27, 6.28. It says there's a reasonable reliance by the borrower on a student loan servicer to act in the interests of the borrower. And I'm just trying to think through what the implications of that would be, or when a potential student loan servicer, you know, could violate that clause.
Senator Umu-Verbaten.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Rasmussen. Again, just thinking about the examples from Mohila that are documented in a recent report, I'm happy to follow up and share that with folks. Their internal documents show that they have encouraged their staff to participate in a call deflection scheme that actually steers customers away from speaking to a live representative, the wait times of over 9 hours. But I think particularly when we're talking about the
sort of repayment plans folks could be in if they're steering you into a payment plan where you're going to be spending more money when you could have been eligible for an income-driven repayment plan. That's a practice that's deceptive. And our borrowers, I think, have an even greater expectation with these loans that they took out with the federal government that they're going to act in their best interest, right? Like, we created these programs so that folks can get that relief. And then it gets contracted over to a servicer who's just trying to get more money from borrowers.
Senator Rasmussen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, the bill author, for that answer. One final question for the bill author, Mr. Chair. As a part of developing the language in front of the committee today, have you sought feedback from student loan servicers, and have they raised any concerns or any conversations that you've had with them?
Senator Umer-Verbaeten.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Rasmussen, I've been in contact with the Student Borrower Protection Center on this, the Department of Commerce, the Attorney General's office. I haven't had any conversations directly with specific student loan servicers, but I think our contracts are really clear with what the federal government has expected them to do. And so when they are violating this, I think it's important for us to update the Student Loan Borrower Bill of Rights. But I'm always willing to have conversations with folks. I haven't heard anything from servicers at this point.
Nor has this committee received testimony from those organizations. But if any are present in the chamber today and would like to testify, they're certainly welcome to do so. Senator Rasmussen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to the bill author for answering the questions. I guess I have a few concerns about moving this bill forward today for a few reasons. One is, when we look at the abusive acts or practices or the private right of action, to me it seems quite broad and perhaps ill-defined in terms of what types of situations we could imagine a student loan servicer tripping up on these different clauses. And additionally, it also concerns me that the bill author hasn't talked with student loan servicers, and we don't have any here to testify in front of the committee. It might not be because they don't have concerns. I'm assuming if we were to give this to a student loan servicer, they would probably have some questions or concerns, but they may not be. You might have national servicers that might not be aware that the Senate Commerce Committee is debating this issue here today. And so I just, again, have concerns about the broadness of this bill and the fact that we haven't gotten direct feedback from those who it would be regulating.
Senator Dames.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Umer-Verbaeten. Could you tell me, earlier in your conversation, you talked about teenagers not always understanding the impact it's going to have when they borrow this money. So where is the disconnect? Why is it that they don't understand this? Is it because they're not getting any classes in high school that talk about economics? Do we need to have a class that says that before you can have a student loan, you have to go through a class and understand what's happening so that you know? How do we get through this barrier if the students borrowing the money don't understand the impact it's going to have? What can we do to change that so that they don't have those surprises?
Senator Umer-Verbaeten.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, I just wanted to respond to an earlier comment and say that the registration that's included in this bill is also really crucial for us to know all the servicers that are operating in this state. So that's important for us to grasp the issue. That's why that's one of the first sections of the bill. To your questions and our names, I think, yes, more education is always great, but I think one of the biggest issues is that students go into this with sort of a level of trust that the federal government is going to sort of properly handle their loans. Many don't even know that it's going to go to a service provider, and they should have this trust that they're going to be placed into the right program, but we know it's been documented that these servicers are like intentionally steering them away from programs that they could benefit from that would lower their payments or potentially, you know, forgive their debt entirely. So I think, yes, on the front end, I believe we worked on some legislation last year about better financial literacy. All of that's really important, but there's like some really crucial pieces that happen after you graduate. Once you get ready for repayment, you get placed with a service provider, and you expect that they're going to have your best interests. And it's just been documented that many do not, and are actually deceiving borrowers and sort of stealing money from folks.
Senator Deems.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Sir.
So to follow that up, so you're saying then that students do, when they borrow money, they do understand if they borrowed X number of percent, and when they get out of college, they're going to have to start paying them back, and whatever number of years they choose is going to be so many dollars it's going to cost them. Do you think that they fully understand that?
Senator Umu verbatim.
Mr. Chair, sir names, I think that, you know, students likely understand that they don't have the money that they need to pay for college, and they have to borrow for it, and they're going to have to repay those loans. But being able to understand the right, you know, payment plan when it is time for them to repay back those loans, I think that's where a lot of the issues come into play here. I think there's an expectation that, you know, I've taken out this debt, now it's time for me to repay it, and that process should be sort of transparent. These folks should have my best interests in mind, and that is where the disconnect is, where servicers are engaging in some really deceptive practices.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Senator Deems.
Well, thank you for your comments, Senator. We certainly appreciate it. I do think there's a little more going on here than what meets the eye. I do think that there's a lot of cases to where students find out at the end what they borrowed, what the cost is going to be, and it's very shocking because they've probably never sat down and thoroughly looked at what they're doing to their future finances. So I think there's more to it than this, but thank you for your bill.
Senator Russ.
Thank you. Senator Umu verbatim, I have a question about Section 11, line 611 to 614, where you have a prohibition for anyone being on the phone for more than 2 hours. It's my experience in recent years that a lot of those entities that get frequent calls, like an insurance company or something, that a practice has been adopted that will let a caller know that they are 14th in line and that the estimated wait time is an hour and a half. And if you would rather leave your phone number and have the service representative call you back, that you may do that. And it seems like to me that your Section 11 is just a bit too prescriptive, and I hope that you'll consider a more general obligation or way in which that makes sense, but rather than just saying 2 hours, you know, so it's 2 hours and 5 minutes. A violation of the law rather than a general formula that people can depend on? And it might not, they might say, you're the 15th caller, but we anticipate getting to you in 20 minutes because they are looking at short, or they're getting a number of short requests or inquiries. I don't have any language, but I hope that you'll consider just looking at that for a more general requirement rather than just a hard stop after 2 hours, and at that point somehow they are violating the law. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Umar verbatim.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Senator Ross. And I do just want to point out that this is based on the documentation of servicers having folks on the line for up to 9 hours and their documents showing that it's like an actual intentional practice to try to steer people away from getting help. So your feedback's well taken. I'm also aware that sometimes the callback options are not working for students, so they're failing to meet their requirements there. But those are things I'm happy to look at. It's just, you know, this is coming from documentation of them keeping folks on the phone for hours and hours and doing so intentionally.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Rust.
I think those of us that prepare tax returns find that to be true with the Department of Revenue, the Federal or the Internal Revenue Service, and their program of letting people know how long it's going to take, including we're, you know, a comment that we're extremely busy and it's likely that we won't get to your call until, we wouldn't get to your call until after closing hours, and suggesting that the least busy times in the morning or something, and they really do reach out because you could be sitting there all day long for 9 hours and them still not getting to you. Mm-hmm. I just think 2 hours is, there's a better and more forceful way of reminding lenders or the Internal Revenue Service. We can't tell them what to do, obviously, but they care about their customers. And I would like to think that even though there might be individual experiences to the contrary, that lenders care about their customers because they want to be paid. And that just seems to me to be something that could be improved and get better results with different language. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Senator.
Senator Rasmussen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to, you know, this bill, I think, was introduced in the Senate and the House on Thursday, and, you know, we're hearing it on Tuesday. We have, you know, the bill authors said that we haven't talked to the student loan servicers who are regulated under this bill. We just asked, Mr. Chair, either for a commitment from you or from the bill author that if we do hear concerns, you know, from folks in this industry, if they have questions or feedback, will we be able to bring this bill back to this committee to discuss it before moving it forward?
Senator Rasmussen, you have my commitment as chair to do that. Further questions or comments, Senator Howe?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Umuber-Baden, you brought up the fact that, you know, students end up running out of money. They need to borrow money to stay in school. And I know that, you know, the colleges have really increased their tuition rates, to me, unbelievably so. And I think a lot of that needs more scrutiny to actually make it college degrees not only more affordable but more applicable to positions of hire when they get done. But one of the things that I guess concerns me is when they say they needed that money because they didn't have it to continue. I think that's a philosophy. There's no required timeline to finish a degree, correct?
Senator Umuber-Baten.
Mr. Chair, Senator Howe, I can't speak directly to that. It's not my understanding that there's a direct timeline, but I think, again, the distinction I would make here is that there are a lot of borrowers who are trying to repay their debt. I'm one of them. I have this servicer who has been documented to be engaging in a lot of misconduct. They're repaying it, and then the servicers are misapplying the payments, they're losing paperwork, they're wrongfully denying their applications for programs that they're entitled to. So again, there's this trust that they have that they're going to fulfill their end of their work as the servicer, and that's just not what's happening for many of our borrowers.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, is, and I understand that there's some, or there's always, no matter where you go, there's some folks out there that go differently than what we'd hope that, and have nefarious, questionable business practices. But I guess what I'd like to make sure is known out there is, you know, I took a 13-year hiatus before I went back and got my degree. There is no requirement to finish it in 3 years, 4 years, 5 years, 10 years. The key thing is when you can't afford it, you go back out, you find yourself a job, you make some money, you put some money away, and you come back, you pay your tuition, you can continue to go. I think what some students need to understand out there is many times going into that size of a debt. In fact, I talked to a young man, he went to college for set design, but that's what he graduated with. And the problem with it was he changed degrees three times in that process, and he was working within his field, and this was probably 15 years ago when I was talking to him, but he had found a job within his field, and he was making roughly about $15, $16 an hour. The problem is he had $144,000 in student debt. And I said, I don't know how to help you because there's no way out of that I'm aware of. And I think that's one of the problems that I see with our university and college system is they're not giving good guidance for these folks to maybe take a pause on education and not dig yourself such a deep hole as you're doing that. But I you know, I think the effort here is commendable. I just, but I agree that we should hear something from the folks that are actually, we're trying to regulate and give them an opportunity to have some input. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Howell. Closing comments on the bill, Senator Mover-Bateson. Any closing comments on the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just, again, want to say from personal experience how hard it is to navigate a lot of these servicers who we don't have a choice, right? Like, we're just assigned these student loan servicers as borrowers. And in the instance of public service forgiveness, there is one servicer that we're stuck with. There's an entire report right now documenting all of their misconduct in just the 6 months since repayments have started. So it's really difficult for our borrowers to pay this back when they're trying to do the right things. And the servicers are just not holding up their end of the bargain. They're denying them access to certain plans or losing paperwork. It's a really, really frustrating process, especially for some of our youngest folks who are, just graduating, just starting out their careers, as well as their families who are supporting them through this process. So I think it's just really important for folks to know that there are people at the legislature who have this personal experience, know what they're going through, and that we are giving our agencies the tools to protect them from this sort of misconduct. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. And with the admonishment of Senator Rasmussen that if we get significant feedback or suggestions to improve the bill, or especially hearing the members' comments today, that there are details that could be expanded upon, we will move this bill to Judiciary today, but are grateful to take it back should significant commerce-related issues arise.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Latz.
I didn't want to step on the author's closing statement. And unfortunately, I had some constituents to meet with during this hearing, but I'm going to sound like a broken record. But this sounds like the kind of thing that stakeholders should have been involved in the conversation, the drafting, and everything else before it got to this committee hearing, not afterward. We're not going to fix that in Judiciary. So if there is input, we'll send it back here. And deadlines will be whatever they are. I don't know why I have to keep saying this. I mean, everyone by now should know that when you come before a committee hearing, you got to be ready to go, and that usually involves notice to stakeholders as well. And I know we're all pushing a lot of stuff through the process. That's and Senator Mover Baton is a very diligent legislator. We shouldn't even be having these conversations in this committee or any other committee for that matter. So if it may, you know, we'll deal with our committee's jurisdiction on the remedies that are in here in judiciary. We're not going to fix, if there are any fixes to be made, on the commerce side of things. And it will either, if it gets out of judiciary, it'll come back here, or it may go to the floor. But my voting to pass it out of committee today is not a promise that I'll vote for it on the floor. If there are stakeholders that have input that needs to be incorporated into this, and I think they're reasonable and ought to be included, I may not be a vote for it on the floor, even though I agree with the whole purpose of the bill. Just sort of putting it out there.
Appreciate you, Senator Latz. Further questions or comments from the committee? The motion is Senator Klein's. The Senate file 4735, as amended, be recommended to pass and then refer to the Committee on Judiciary.
With all due respect, Mr. Chairman, I don't think the chair can make a motion.
Senator Seeberger's motion that 4735 as amended be recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Judiciary and Public Safety. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Bill is on the way. Senator Limmer. Members, we have a full agenda both today and Thursday. We will get through as much as we can of both those agendas, but we do have the room reserved on Friday should we fail to complete our agendas. Welcome to the committee, Senator. Senate file 3486 is in front of the committee. 3846.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The bill before you, Senate File 3846, relates to real property and especially regarding the issue of a transfer on death deed. It's a property transferring tool that functions like a payable upon death designation on a bank account. They're commonly referred to as TODs, transfer on death deed. It enables beneficiaries to also take ownership of a property when the current owner dies and potentially avoids probate. This bill is from the Minnesota State Bar Association to address some weaknesses in the existing law that we have. The bill deals, as I said, transfer of death deeds. It's a popular way to transfer property outside of the probate system. This committee has jurisdiction over Section 2 of the bill. For those members that were on the Judiciary Committee where it originated, I want to thank you for your early support. However, this area, Section 2, deals with the insurance issues and how insurance is transferred when someone dies, and then a TOD gets affected. I have attorney Brian Lake from the Minnesota State Bar Association to fill in any details that you might have.
Mr. Lake, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Brian Lake. I operate a law firm in Minneapolis, and I represent the Minnesota State Bar Association. I want to thank Senator Limmer for carrying this bill. Usually when I'm shopping around technical real estate bills, people run away in terror from me, but Senator Limmer is always willing to dig into the intricacies of real property law, and I really appreciate that. So as he mentioned, I believe this committee's focus is in Section 2, and what we're doing there is dealing with a recent Eighth Circuit Court decision. The case is called Strope Robinson, a really interesting case where there was a married couple. They got divorced. Husband had the house. Shortly before the husband died, he executed a transfer and recorded a transfer on death deed, giving future interest in the property to his niece. Then upon his death, the interest automatically transferred to her. That's how a transfer on death deed works. At the moment of death, it transfers from the grantor to the beneficiary. But shortly after that, his ex-wife burned down the house. A lot more backstory to it, but it's a pretty interesting case. The niece then tried to get the decedent's insurance company to cover the damages. They refused. The case was then litigated. And what the court found was that under Minnesota law, an insurance policy runs with the person, not with the property. In other words, at the moment of the decedent's death, the insurance lapsed. So the niece, who had been the beneficiary of the transfer on death deed, was basically left with a pile of ashes. So this is a scenario that is, you know, attorneys are aware of this or should be, and they can advise their clients accordingly to either add the intended beneficiary as an additional named insured on the policy or to make sure that the grantor tells the beneficiary, hey, when I pass away, you need to immediately get property insurance on this. The problem we're trying to address is a lot of people execute transfer on death deeds on their own. They're not represented by counsel. They aren't aware of this case. And they can put themselves in a position where the beneficiary has no insurance coverage after the grantor dies. So I brought this issue to the Insurance Federation, and they were aware of it. And to their great credit, they agreed that it was an issue that needed to be dealt with because people were put in really tough situations. I want to thank Mr. Cocking, just an absolute professional, really, really a pleasure to deal with him. They worked with us over the course of the last year, collaborating with us to come up with Section 2 of the bill. And it does two really important things that the committee should know about. One is it allows the grantor's property insurance to be extended for 30 days after the grantor dies. So usually the beneficiary is, you know, a friend or family member of the grantor. So that beneficiary is, at the time of the death, is grieving the loss of their loved ones. The last thing on their mind is, oh, I need to go out and get insurance coverage right away. This buys them some time. They'll have 30 days to go do that. And then the other thing it does is it adds a warning on the transfer on death deed form. That'll be changed, assuming this becomes law. So in Minnesota, all real estate forms are promulgated by the Bar Association and then approved by the Department of Commerce. They're called Uniform Conveyancing Blanks. So if you just Google Transfer on Death Deed Minnesota, one of those will pop up. That will, assuming this passes, now have a warning on it. So the grantor is aware that there's insurance issues, and they want to make sure that those get dealt with appropriately if they're executing a transfer on death deed. So essentially, Mr. Chair, what we're doing with the bill is trying to encourage communication between the grantor, the beneficiaries, and the insurer to make sure that there aren't any lapses in coverage. And with that, I'd be happy to take questions.
Thank you, Mr. Lake. Are there questions or comments or amendments from the committee? Thank you, Senator Limmer. Any closing comments to your bill?
No, Mr. Chair. I know when to stop.
A co-author on the bill is Senator Latz. With your permission, Senator Latz moves that Senate file 3846 be recommended to pass and sent to the Senate floor. All those in favor, say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The bill is passed. Thank you, Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Senator Rest. Senator Ress, Senate file 4163 is before the committee. I think you have an author's amendment.
Mr. Chairman, I do have the A2.
Senator Ress offers the A2 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Senator Ress, to your bill.
Thank you very much. Senate file 4163. Changes the circumstances and the number of gallons, if you will, or at least limits it to delivery of gasoline that is not ethanol. And right now, that is against the law to do that, except in very minor amounts and for specific purposes. And what the bill does, that actually the most of the amendment was in an A1 amendment that was not a delete all amendment. But I want to go back to that language. And what it does is to set up conditions under which it would be possible to increase the bulk delivery of premium gasoline. Doesn't change any of the, in the second section, doesn't change any of the prohibited uses, but it does allow bulk delivery to be made if there's only one bulk storage unit on a property, and it amounts to 500 gallons or less. So it's still a restriction again on the types of vehicles that you can use premium gas in. And it's always been a bone of contention about whether that is necessary, that, I mean, why not be able to use ethanol and everything? But we have permitted this exemption in the past, and this is a modernization of that in terms of the purchase and storage of it, without changing any of the restrictions on its use, and that is made clear in the A2 amendment.
Thank you, Senator. Mr. Tim Gross, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Tim Gross. I'm the executive director of Fueling Minnesota. We represent the 400 licensed fuel distributors who own and operate the majority of convenience stores and current refueling sites across the state. I'd like to thank Senator Ress for carrying this bill and Senator Rasmussen for his help on developing this language. In our state of Minnesota, where we have a statute that mandates all gasoline sold in our state to have at least a minimal level of blended ethanol of 10% or more, and except for some certain exemptions that are stated in statute. I'll give you, there's only four or five of them. I'll just read them really quick. Exemption for an airport, exemption for resorts, marinas, and houseboat rental companies, exemption for motorsports racing, exemptions for landowners who are adjacent to a lake or stream, and exemptions for aircraft operators, and exemptions for recreational vehicle manufacturers like snowmobiles and boats and things that they can do research and development. The last is the exemption for collector vehicles and off-road use. So basically, like Senator Ress stated, this is just an addition onto that current exemption right now, which wouldn't change any of the specifics or requirements or restrictions of that. What it really is involves is right now a consumer who has, like for example, a lawn service company, a landscape company, or a golf course, they wouldn't be able to bring all their equipment to our current retail sites. Currently, it's legal to purchase this product, we call it non-oxygenated premium gasoline, at our retail sites. But in this situation, they're allowed to only take 6-gallon cans, and this is not only a convenience bill for consumers, but also a safety issue. Where those type of users may be required to go at multiple times with many tanks for their need for that equipment that requires from their manufacturer of non-ethanol, non-oxygenated gas, that now we'd be able to bulk deliver with a 6-gallon multiple delivery of gas in their back of their pickup versus us delivering the product in a commercial vehicle that's hazmat rated cargo tank driven by a licensed commercial driver who is hazmat and tanker endorsed. So again, this is a safety issue, and this is on a state for sure that this is not a way to decrease ethanol use in our state or increase traditional fuels. It's just a shift from our retail sites currently right now to a bulk delivery. And it's important that these deliveries are under that requirement are would be less than five small deliveries to these sites with all the requirements under subdivision 12 exemption. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Gross, questions or comments from the committee? Senator Lyons.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Senator Rester, whoever can answer the question. Paragraph B in here defines non-oxygenated gas's use. Is that not defined somewhere else in Minnesota statute, or is there? I'm not sure how that definition fits in with the exemption. Little concerned maybe there's a broader impact here of defining a particular kind of gas for a particular kind of use beyond the question of the commerce question here about delivery.
Mr. Chairman, I don't understand the question.
Senator Rest, let me call forward Mr. Kelly from the Department of Commerce.
Beg pardon?
Senator Rest, I'm going to call forward Mr. Kelly from the Department of Commerce to assist with the answer. Mr. Kelly, please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Chair. For the record, John Kelly, Director of Government Affairs for the Department of Commerce. Senator Latz, to your question, the use of non-oxygenated premium gasoline is defined in Subdivision 12 of the statute, and it allows for collector vehicles, vehicles eligible to be licensed as collector vehicles, off-road vehicles, motorcycles, boats, snowmobiles, or small engines. Mm-hmm. Only one tank at the location can store non-oxygenated premium gasoline, and the delivery must not be greater than 500 gallons.
Senator Latz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Kelly, if non-oxygenated gas is already defined elsewhere in this section, what is the purpose or need for putting paragraph B in this bill to define it again?
Mr. Kelly.
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Gross,
Senator Latz, in the 2A amendment, it just refers to that section of subdivision 12 for the use that change in that amendment.
Mr. Kelly,
we're correct, Chair Senator Latz. We're not changing the definition. We're just referring to the definition that's in sub 12.
Any other questions or comments from the committee?
Gotcha. I see, Mr. Chairman,
Senator Lyons.
I see the A2 amendment just created a cross-reference. Thank you.
Senator Rasmussen moves that Senate File 4163 is amended, be recommended to pass, and sent to the Senate floor. All those in favor say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Bill passes. Thank you.
Senator Klein, you are here on Senate File 4156. To your bill.
Thank you, Chair and Committee. Senate File 4156 is the Department of Commerce bill regarding securities policy this year. It includes updates to statutes and direction to the department to do rulemaking that will allow the Commerce Department to better serve Minnesota's investment advisor representatives, investors, consumers, and businesses. And I'd like to turn it over to the department.
Thank you. Mr. Kelly, please identify yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair. For the record, John Kelly, Director of Government Affairs for the Minnesota Department of Commerce. As Chair Klein referenced, this is the department's securities policy bill. This is the department's first securities modernization bill in as long as I've been at the department, so it's been a long time. The bill does the following. It includes a notice filing requirement for Regulation A Tier 2 securities offerings. This is a federal notice We just want to have that note. Many states have the notice also come to the state regulator. We just want to know what's in the field. This isn't in going into any oversight. It's just for awareness. There's no fee associated with the filings, and this is just going to help Minnesota align with other states. The bill also updates the examination requirements of an investment advisor representative to include the general securities representative examination series 7. So the reference to series 7 examination was struck from this section of statute in a cleanup bill from the department a number of years ago. And the Attorney General's office, our attorneys general that represent us, asked us to put that back in as a belt and suspenders. Most folks have a series 7 or series 66 license together, and we just are making that explicit again. The bill also will direct the Department of Commerce to do updates to the investment advisor representative continuing education in Minnesota rules. This is to incorporate the North American Securities Administrators Association Model CE rules. So we'll be doing that under the good cause exemption. And then lastly, right now, this would add an addition to the financial stipulations regarding franchise fees that an investor would pay a franchisor. So currently, administratively, the department waives the need to pay that initial fee until the franchisor is up and running, and we'd like to put that into statute so that we're not just doing it administratively. We think that this is some important updates, both on our franchise and our security side here at the state. The investment advisor representative rulemaking, you know, updating the rules that pertain to that will bring us into alignment with Wisconsin, North Dakota, and 16 other states that are moving this way. We have worked with industry on this bill, the Financial Planners Association of Minnesota and others, and we think this is an important update to our securities rules and statutes, as well as our making things a little easier for folks who want to do a franchise here in Minnesota. With that, stand for questions.
Any questions or comments from our members? All right, seeing none, Senator Klein, any closing thoughts?
No, Chair.
Question is on the motion of Senator Wicklund that Senate file 4163 as amended be recommended to, or excuse me, 4156 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on State and Local Government and Veterans. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed say no. Motion is passed and the bill is referred. All right, the next one, Senator Klein, 4157, two-year bill.
Thank you, Chair. Another non-controversial Department of Commerce bill with a zero fiscal note policy bill. This one governing financial institutions policy, and I'll turn it over to the testifier.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Senator Klein, for bringing this bill forward. This is the Department's Financial Institutions Division policy bill. This will make updates to Minnesota's banking statutes and rules. It'll replace Deputy Commissioner as the final approver for detached facility applications and change it to Chief Examiner. It'll allow banks that branch in non-adjoining states to utilize already established lending limits, and it will direct the department to do rules and updates to rules to classify when a bank can classify real estate as held for future expansion will be up to 10 years. It amends 47.20 to replace the $100,000 cap on loan amount for high interest rates to the Federal Housing Finance Agency definition, so it'll move as the feds shift and we don't have to continue to change it. We would love to all be able to buy a house for $100,000 still, but it's not something that's possible in this market anymore, and we want to just have the law move with the current market. It adds updates in Chapter 58 for our mortgage statutes, and it updates the Mortgage Originator and Servicer Licensing Act passed in 1998. The bill so we think this is a good bill. We have been working with our banking and mortgage industries to just continue to update the statute so it's clear for them. It reflects the current practices in the market, and we think it's a good bill.
Any questions or comments from our members? All right, seeing none, Senator Klein, any final thoughts? All right, the question then is on the motion of Senator Frentz that Senate File 4157 be re-referred to the Committee on State and Local Government and Veterans. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed say no. Motion passes and the bill is referred. Finally, Senator Klein, you have Senate File 3623. To your bill.
Thank you, Chair and members. Senate File 3623. Was brought forth by the industry and prohibits the sale of certain empty packaging, which could be used to mimic a childhood product such as a breakfast cereal or something along those lines, and would then be filled with cannabis and would be dangerous to minors or others. We intend it has a fiscal note, which is zero, and we intend to pass it to the floor as a potential vehicle bill for cannabis policy, and I do have a testifier.
All right, thank you. I'd invite Ivana Stark to the testifiers table. No? Oh, never mind. Oh, I'm sorry. Who? Oh, Mike Giese. Sorry about that. Could you introduce yourself, please, and begin your testimony?
Thank you, Chair. Senator Dames and members of the committee. My name is Mike Giese, and I'm the Chief Intellectual Property Counsel at General Mills. General Mills is a Fortune 500 company located in Golden Valley, Minnesota. We make food the world loves, including beloved household brands such as Cheerios, Betty Crocker, Cinnamon Toast Crunch, and Trix. I'm here today because General Mills has been actively working with law enforcement in instances where marijuana edibles have been sold in packaging that illegally uses our brands and logos, and sometimes even adulterated versions of our actual products. Sellers of marijuana edibles purchase pre-printed bags with our company's brand imagery on them, fill the bags with marijuana-laced consumables, and then sell the products to consumers. Over the last several years, poison control centers across the nation have fielded thousands of calls relating to accidental THC exposure, the vast majority of which involve children. General Mills and our peer food companies spend millions of dollars every year to ensure that our products meet stringent safety standards. When the public sees our brands, they rightly expect that the products are safe to consume. The use of our brands on THC products gives the false impression that these products come from us, and it dangerously misleads the public into believing that there's a reputable food safety assurance that comes with these products. While Minnesota's cannabis law already prohibits the sales of products and packaging like this, it's not illegal to manufacture or sell empty bags, pre-printed and ready to fill. The legislation presented today is narrowly scoped to packaging that, once filled, would violate the cannabis laws passed last year. As Minnesota's marijuana market continues to grow, now is the time to take this extra step to protect your constituents, especially children, from the ingestion posed by copycat edibles. I ask for this committee's support for the bill.
Any questions or comments from our members? All right, seeing none, any final thoughts, Senator Klein? Okay. Which one am I on? The question is on the motion of Senator Wicklund that Senate File 3623, did we amend it? No. Be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Senate floor. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed say no. The motion is passed and the bill is headed to the floor. Thank you.
Welcome to the committee, Senator Housley, pinch hitting for Senator May Quaid. Appreciate your doing that. Senate File 4114 is in front of the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. Thank you for agreeing to hear Senate File 4114, which will remove the requirement that toxic flame retardant chemicals be added to recreational camping, backpacking, mountaineering, or children's play tents. Minnesota is one of only two states, the other one being New York State, in the country that has not updated its laws around this issue. And until we do, we are unnecessarily exposing our children, consumers, and our waterways to toxic chemicals. Duke University did a study that found that skin exposure to flame retardants occurs from handling camping tents and breathing the air that's inside them. Most people don't know that there are flame retardants in these tents, but the study found that carcinogens on the hands of those handling the tents were 29 times greater after putting up the tents. This retardant isn't needed anymore because the materials that they're making tents out of now, ever since 1980, is made of polyester and nylon, which will actually melt if there's a fire. But before, it was made out of heavy cotton that had this thick wax over it. So this bill would remove the requirement to continue to put the heavy wax with the flame retardants on the fabric that doesn't really need it anymore. Children in particular have frequent hand-to-mouth contact without washing their hands, so they have a higher frequency of ingesting. Firefighters support this bill, as do many, many more, and I am grateful for the bipartisan support. And I'm glad to pitch in for Senator May Quaid. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Housel. You answered my one question, which was, what was the opinion of the firefighter community on this bill? You have no amendments. Ms. Ivana Stark, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Chair Klein and members, I'm Ivana Stark, State Director of Clean Water Action, and we have 132,000 members rather, in Minnesota who support clean water across the state. I'm here in support of Senate File 4114, which will put Minnesota in line with every other state in the country other than New York. We're going to let them figure themselves out. And we thank Senator May Quaid for bringing this forward and Senator Housley for showing up to present it as a co-author today. The one pager that we submitted gives the history of flame retardants in tents and explains why so many states have made this language update. And today I'm going to help you understand the implications of doing nothing. The International Association of Firefighters have supported this bill across the country, saying that, quote, flame retardants do not provide a meaningful fire safety benefit in lightweight synthetic tents, yet their use means that during the very small number of tent fires that do occur, the smoke will be more toxic, creating a more hazardous fire for both tent users and firefighters. It is well known that the smoke toxicity causes the majority of injuries and deaths from fires. A coalition of outdoor businesses and organizations, including REI, Coleman, IKEA, Columbia, Roughwear, Sierra Business Council, NRDC, Non-Toxic Schools, EWG, and more, have supported removing this requirement across the country because of the health concerns related to flame retardants. Minnesota consumers will benefit from this bill. Currently, only tents coated in these toxic flame retardants can be sold. And when that limitation is lifted, consumers will enjoy a larger inventory and more choosing power when they shop. A study tested breast milk from unregulated toxic flame retardants present. It also found that toxic substances that had been banned in years prior were found to be decreasing in blood tests over time. PBDE, a type of flame retardant, has decreased in tests by 70% after being banned 20 years ago. Unfortunately, other types of flame retardants that are not regulated were still present in 88% of the samples. Flame retardants from outdoor gear such as tents enter our water with rain runoff, and when items are discarded and thrown away, they also enter the groundwater through landfills. And I think many of you have heard me say over and over that 98 out of our 101 landfills are leaching into the groundwater. So this is a strong bill. It'll bring us into alignment with every other state in the country. I do know that New York is working on this as well, so hopefully they join us. And I appreciate the committee's attention to this bipartisan effort. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Ms. Stark. This will be a good excuse to go to REI and buy a new tent. No longer
for a
sprayed
lot
with chemicals. Yeah, and cheaper. Member Senator Howell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Housley. I know you're pitch hitting here, but has this, has this been run by the State Fire Marshal's Office? I know you've got input from the International Association of Firefighters, which as a former member has long been, because of the cancer thing that we've been fighting as firefighters for a long time, been concerned with that. My concern is, though, is as you are correct that the nylon polyester does not burn, but when you say it melts and sticks, and it's worse than a burn. So my question is, have you contacted the Minnesota State Fire Marshal's Office, NFPA, the Consumers Product Safety Commission? All of those are concerned with the concern for products. And as you well noted, I believe in my research, there's three states, including Minnesota, that require the CPAI 84 test. But there's 16 states that require the NFPA 701 test. So flame retardant is still a huge requirement out there in the country. And my concern is if we don't include everyone because right now I enforce the Minnesota State Fire Code that requires this. And if we don't coordinate the effort here, we're gonna have conflicting requirements that are gonna, to me, be problematic. So my question is, have you contacted these other and got input from those folks?
Senator Halsey, understanding you're pinch hitting to the best of your ability.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Senator Howe. Yes, we have, and I think Ms. Stark has the what the conversation was in their support.
Ms. Stark.
Yes, Chair and Senator Howe. Part of the problem is this process is moving a little bit quicker than the others can respond, and so we've been engaging these conversations. Like I said, Minnesota and New York are the last two states to take action on this. It's really being viewed as a language cleanup because these tents are melting and not bursting into flames. The concern is that really all that having these flame retardants are accomplishing is creating really toxic fumes. So they don't see a difference in the way that these tents are melting or falling apart during fires with or without the flame retardants. And the big difference is what the firefighters are breathing in.
I have a follow-up question actually for Senator Howe. I know you have some experience in firefighting, so is it your impression that these chemicals prevent that nylon melt or are impactful on that? Because the assertion of the witness is that they're not, that they don't slow it down. Can you advise the committee on that?
Yes, it does slow it down. It doesn't slow it down immensely. If you look at these standards, the CPAI test, you put a flame to it for 4 seconds, and in order to pass the test, it has to be less than a 255 millimeter damage. The 701 test from NFPA is a 12-second impingement with flame, and that is a much more detailed, harder test to pass. But there are still 16 states that require tents to pass that test. That's the deal, that's the requirement because they're looking for the slow growth. And my concern is we require this on tents that currently, if you're having a party someplace and you've got a large tent, if you're selling fireworks, a lot of these, and we go out and we inspect and check for all this. So, and it's in the state fire code. My concern is you know, you're taking out a large amount of these. I know they increased it from, you know, they're eliminating those that used to be 10 or more. Now it's 15 or more. I don't understand why we're increasing it to 15, why the difference is there. If you look at, you know, California removed this. They used to have it, but you go out and look at, if you want to Google tent fires and look at the number of homeless camps. In fact, we've had them right here in Minnesota in September, the homeless camps that we've had large fires in. I'm not quite sure where these where they bought their tents or where they came from, or whether they've updated or if they had the flame retardant on them or not. But to say that they don't burn, I find that hard to believe. I've had a lot of experience
seeing tents in people's backyards and kids being lucky to get out. So my concern is to me, and I think we need to have that input from the State Fire Marshal's office and have somebody or get a response from NFPA and the Consumer Product Safety Commission before we push this and make this state law.
Other comments from the committee?
Mr. Chair, where does this bill go after here?
Senator Housley, the plan was to send this on to the Senate floor, but I will say that the expertise offered by Senator Howe is compelling, and we don't have the chief author with us today. So I'm going to lay this bill over and have the option to bring it back up when the parties that you've spoken about can come and advise us. Senator Howe.
Mr. Chair, the other piece is I seriously believe that this is a public safety issue, and I believe it's, you know, I would make the motion to send it to Judiciary and Public Safety and take that testimony there, because I believe it's a public safety issue, and that's kind of the reason I'm on the Public Safety, Judiciary and Public Safety Committee, is I think these are the issues that need to be dealt with at that level, but I'll leave that up to the chair to have that decision on whether it actually should be dealt with at that in that committee, or if that's the jurisdiction of this committee.
Senator Latz.
Mr. Chairman, as far as I'm aware, the Judiciary Committee has not requested the bill. If it's the chair's intent to lay it over right now to take further input, I think that'd be a good first step, and then I'll have staff take a look at, and council take a look at whether or not Judiciary Public Safety Committee should see it after that.
Senator Seeberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am also a member of the fire department and have gone through quite a bit of fire training. And anecdotally, I can tell you that from everything that I've seen, the general consensus is that these fire retardant materials do not make an appreciable difference in the materials that are currently in use now that are primarily petroleum-based. So I remember this video I see all the time, and I'm sure Senator Howe has seen it too, where they set a room on fire and it's got legacy materials in it, you know, the couch with wool and stuffed with other materials, and then a modern room filled with furniture you buy today, which is in large part petroleum-based, and just the amount of time that each room goes up in flames. It's about 3 to 5 minutes for the modern room filled with current modern furniture to be fully engulfed in flames, and it's about 20 minutes for the legacy furniture to even start catching fire to reach a flash point. And from what I understand, the research shows that there is no fire retardant on the market that will appreciably diminish the amount of time that current materials reach that flash point. So I think what I understand Senator Howe saying is that there's probably some state fire marshal regulations that maybe need to be reconciled with regard to their applicability. But from everything I've learned in my fire training on the fire department over the last 10 years shows that it's the materials themselves, not the fire retardant that goes on it. So in my view, the toxicity of them far outweighs any millisecond of benefit you might gain for their use, for what that's worth.
It's extremely helpful. Senator Howe.
Mr. Chair, I will tell you, I think the difference here is when you look at, when you're looking at rooms, you're looking at furniture that's filled with polyester and nylon, all products of petroleum that burn in seconds, and that's exactly what these tents are made out of. And so that's, to me, that delay is going to give those kids a chance to get out, and that's what I'm looking at. But if you look at lines 2.1 to 2.4, it specifically says it needs to meet the standards from the Commissioner of Public Safety for flame resistivity. And to say that we're going to move this bill without having that office involved in the discussion, I think, flies in the face of the right answer. So I think we need them involved somewhere here, whether it's in this committee or the next committee. You know, and if it takes me to make the motion to move it to the Public Safety Committee, the Judiciary and Public Safety, I'll make that motion. But I believe that we need to deal with that issue.
Senator Howell, so the plan for now, and hopefully it's satisfactory to you, is will be to lay this bill on the table. I will ask the chief author, Senator McQuaid, to sort of reach out to the fire marshal and other entities that you have asked feedback from and obtain that feedback. We will then take it from the table when that's available and get testimony. And then at that point, if necessary, pass it on to Judiciary. Is that a okay route for you? All right. Members, with that, Senate File 4114. Thank you, Senator Housley. Senate File 4114 is laid over. And there's no further business. Oh, sorry. Senate File 4314, Senator Gustafson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Senator Gustafson, welcome to the committee. You have Senate File 4314 before the body.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. It is astounding, though perhaps not surprising, that financial and economic abuse is prevalent in 99% of domestic abuse cases. In 2023, Minnesota became the third state to offer a judicial path for a survivor of domestic violence or a victim of sex or labor trafficking to be relieved of coerced debt. Coerced debt is a debt that was involuntarily incurred. So forced upon the survivor under threat or coercion by an abuser, extinguished. The law went into effect January 1st of 2024. Over the interim, the Minnesota Bankers Association, which was instrumental in working with us to get the bill passed, asked to clarify some language that was contained in the 2023 coerced debt bill. The bill modifies several definitions, strengthens the language that allows the liability to be placed on the abuser where it belongs, clarifies what documentation the survivor must submit to a creditor when notifying that creditor that a debt isn't coerced, clarifies certain procedural requirements regarding the court action, and makes a technical change regarding the presumption of coercion suggested by Senate counsel. I want to thank the Minnesota Bankers Association for working closely with us on these changes. I'd also like to thank the other stakeholders with whom we consulted, the Minnesota Credit Union Network, Great Lakes Credit, Collections Association, Banks in Minnesota, and Credit Data Industry Association. I urge your support. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Gustafson. Mr. Elwood, please introduce yourself for the record. Proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Ron Elwood with Legal Aid. I'm just really here for questions, but I also want to echo Senator Gustafson's appreciation for the Bankers Association, the Great Lakes Credit and Collections Association, the Minnesota Credit Union Network. I think there's a letter in your packet support from the Credit Union Network. We really appreciate their help, and I appreciate Senator Gustafson taking the lead on protecting survivors of violence and carrying these bills. Appreciate it very much.
Member questions or concerns? Senator Rasmussen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just wanted to, you know, Mr. Elwood and I don't always agree on different public policy issues that come before the committee, but I do want to credit him with always reaching out to stakeholders and impacted parties, and I think that's how we get bills like this today where folks have no questions or minimal comments. So I just want to appreciate the work of the bill author and Mr. Elwood.
Senator Gustafson, final comments on your bill.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. And I would just echo what Senator Rasmussen said, and that, yes, Ron Elwood and the work that he put into this bill to make it right is just invaluable. So I appreciate his time, all the stakeholders for coming to the table, and for the committee for hearing the bill. So thank you.
Thank you, Senator Gustafson. The question is on the motion of Senator Frentz that Senate File 4314 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Judiciary and Public Safety. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Members, that's the end of our business. We are adjourned.